WGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, December 8th, 2021. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Alexis Kenyon is operating the board. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Boulder Beat's Shay Castle will join us to give us the highlights of last night's city council meeting and to discuss her recent piece on why affordable housing is so hard to find in this expensive city. Then we'll go to Wyoming to check in on efforts to restore sagebrush habitats. Chris Moore has his weekly commentary, Make Them Hear You, and herbalist Brigitte Mars will bring us her regular Wednesday feature, Naturally. A BBC update and commentary from Jim Hightower are at the bottom of the hour. And then we'll hear the new Rising Tide podcast, followed by the latest episode of Just Solutions with Maeve Conran. At 9:30, Ginger Perry will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead this morning, after these headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
The Omicron variant of COVID-19 has been detected in Boulder's wastewater system. However, it does not currently appear to be widespread. At a news conference yesterday, Rachel Herlihy, the state's epidemiologist, said that while the testing of wastewater cannot determine how many people may be infected with the variant, the results suggest that it is more than one person with some low level of community transmission. And while the Omicron variant doesn't appear to be causing more hospitalizations where it was first detected in South Africa, Herlihy said that it does seem to be spreading more rapidly than the Delta variant. Data for the state's COVID-19 cases seem to be up and down. Yesterday, the number of those hospitalized rose to over 1,400 after falling for about a week. Herlihy said that it's not known yet if there was a short-term effect from Thanksgiving gatherings. She also said that those Coloradans who get a COVID-19 vaccine booster are nearly 50 times less likely to be hospitalized after contracting the disease compared to those who are not vaccinated. Other data also show the booster is having a clear impact on the virus. In September and November, those who got the booster in Colorado were 2.5 times less likely to test positive than those who were fully vaccinated but did not get a booster. And they were much less vulnerable than those who were unvaccinated. Early this morning, the Douglas County School Board voted to get rid of its mask mandate because of the coronavirus. Nine News reports that the vote was 4-3. About 100 people had signed up to comment on the requirement, the majority of whom were against it. The board listened for about 3 hours before taking a vote. The new Aurora City Council was sworn in on Monday evening, in which conservatives now have the edge. While the city's elections are technically nonpartisan, the Sentinel reports that the Republican members chose not to wear masks in defiance of the mandate that is currently in place. Some of Aurora's council members have written a letter urging the city to opt out of the mask mandate from the Tri-County Health Department. The Boulder County Commissioners approved an amended policy about its farmlands yesterday. The unanimous vote came after months of debate and revisions. The Daily Camera reports that the updated policy allows genetically engineered sugar beets and corn to be grown on county land. While economically viable substitutes for GMO crops have been considered, the county needs more research to find alternatives. In addition, the new policy says that neonicotinoid pesticides will be phased out beginning on December 31st. However, some will be allowed for certain farms and will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis. Commissioner Marta Lotreman said that she believes the county's farmers have to be supported because they are the experts in the industry and have a deep connection to the land they care for daily. Colorado Secretary of State is asking for funding from the legislature because of threats to her and her staff. Jenna Griswold wants $200,000 annually for guards and monitoring, according to the Colorado Sun. Many threats have been made by those who baselessly see the 2020 election as fraudulent. Some of the threats are very specific, such as saying to the Secretary of State or a staffer that they should be afraid, and the person making the threat knows where they sleep. The Secretary of State has appeared recently on national television criticizing Republicans who question voting systems and attack the results of the last presidential election, and she's been involved in assuring that elections in Mesa County on the West Slope are secure and conducted appropriately. The money Griswold is requesting would be used mostly to track threats on social media platforms and to provide guards for her and her staff at public events. U.S. Representative Ed Perlmutter from Jefferson County is expressing his frustration over the Senate's failure to pursue a bill that would allow marijuana businesses access to the banking system. CBS 4 reports that Perlmutter has spent years trying to get the Safe Banking Act passed. He says that marijuana businesses are vulnerable to violent criminals because they have to use cash-only transactions. Perlmutter's proposal was dropped from the federal defense spending bill yesterday. He vowed, however, to continue fighting for it. A professor at the University of Colorado Boulder will appear this week on the popular game show Jeopardy! Ashley Lawrence Sanders started teaching history at the University of Colorado Boulder in August, the first black person in the department. And now she has taken part in the show's first ever professor's tournament, which was taped earlier. Lawrence Sanders said in a release from the university that it was a dream come true, but also very nerve-wracking. She said she's prepared by watching old episodes every night. The tournament began airing Monday, and Lawrence Sanders first appears on the show tonight on KDVR. In today's weather, there will be increasing clouds with a high of 53 and an overnight low of 36. Tomorrow, the high will be about 53, and there's a small chance of rain early in the morning, with rain and snow likely in the late morning and into the night. On Friday, snow is likely until late morning. Right now, it's about 30 degrees in Boulder, 34 in Denver, and 24 in Fort Collins. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Joining me now, as so often the case on Wednesday mornings, is Boulder Beat News' Shay Castle. Good morning, Shay.
Good morning.
And we do what we do on Wednesday mornings to give you the recap of the city council meeting. Tell us what happened.
Well, last night was a study session, so no official action was taken, but we did get an interesting look at some of the things that the city is working on, including an update on their racial equity efforts. Listeners might remember that Boulder adopted a racial equity plan in February that has a very ambitious goal, which is basically to identify all the ways that city policies and programs and laws might have racist implications, and then stop doing those things to rid the city of institutional racism, essentially. We also got a preview of the city's snow and ice removal plans. It seems quite odd given how dry it is, but we should have some snow eventually. So it's good to know what those look like. And the last thing was an update on another ambitious city goal, which is Vision Zero, which is the goal to stop severe injury and death crashes with cars. So we saw how that was going. But like I said, council didn't do anything. They just listened a lot and gave some feedback.
And are there any policies in particular that are up for review or for changing that they identified in their racial equity plan?
Well, they did identify a couple of priority areas where racial equity is already being assessed and applied, such as the COVID response. We saw a lot of disparity when it came to, early on who was getting COVID and who was being hospitalized. So they really focused the vaccine distribution in an equitable way to erase those disparities. And they largely have. But the racial equity tool is supposed to be eventually applied to basically everything the city does, every decision, every policy change. So right now, when council gets its notes before it considers basically anything, should we grant this easement? Should we annex this land? They get a list of, how this will impact, the social structure of Boulder, how this will impact the environment. What's the cost of this? So racial equity really should be applied to essentially everything. But obviously, that's a huge undertaking. So they have focused it on a few areas for now.
Well, the cost of living is one of those things that obviously skews the demographics of Boulder. And given the way that systemic racism has shaped the accumulation of wealth in this country, are there any plans to make affordable housing more accessible so that Boulder's population can more closely reflect the towns around it?
That was a big issue early on when the plan was being drafted. I don't know if readers will recall, but the first draft of the plan and the final version very very strongly called out Boulder's housing and land use policies, which do keep it an expensive place. And there are things that we love, like open space and the height limit. And also, those have had tremendous racial implications, as you mentioned, because of the cost of housing. So those are in the plan. Those are definitely called out. When we'll get to those and, you know, how big a fight that will be, that really remains to be seen.
And you covered the ways in which rules affect the construction of affordable housing in Boulder in your most recent piece on boulderbeat.news. Give listeners the summary of that.
Well, there are a lot of rules, so I'll try to go quickly. But essentially what I focused on were rules specific to this one development that's being discussed now, which is at, on Spruce, Folsom and Pearl area. It's a sizable chunk of land, a couple acres, but they can only put 63 or 64 units there. And the council wants more housing, but there are a lot of laws on the books that impact why we get such big housing. But a couple of them are that, you know, we require a certain amount of open space per unit. We literally limit, like, you have to have this much land per each unit. It's called lot area. And then the city's inclusionary housing fees, which are great and necessary, but they're also per unit. So there's really an incentive there to do fewer units. And then you have to do fewer open space, smaller lot areas, and less affordable housing. So there's a lot of things like that that really incentivize big units. And let's not forget the market factors too. You know, that's profitable for developers. And there are people who want big luxury condos. So those factors can't be ignored either.
Well, anybody who wants to get into the weeds with Shay about the rules surrounding the construction of affordable housing in Boulder City can do so by going to boulderbeat.news. Shay, we are out of time for today. Thank you so much, as always, for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
The Biden administration recently announced it's considering new measures to protect the greater sage grouse, birds best known for their spectacular mating dances. According to the Audubon Society, the greater sage grouse population has plummeted by 80% since 1965. Their sagebrush habitats across western states are in peril from fires, mining, and oil and gas development. But those habitats are now getting help from an unexpected source, incarcerated men and women. H2O Radio's Franny Halperin reports.
For decades, TV and movies have depicted cowboys driving cattle through sagebrush country, a desolate place dotted with gray-green shrubs. Even today, a drive down a highway in the West gives the impression it's monotonous terrain with little value. You know, flyover country. But don't let Gina Klingerman hear you call it a wasteland.
I mean, this is a national treasure that people don't realize is here.
Gina is with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, and I'm walking with her on this very windy day through rolling hills in southern Wyoming, where a wildfire last year torched 14,000 acres of so-called sagebrush steppe, a landscape that she says is in peril.
It is at risk. It is being destroyed piece by piece. You know, oh, we're going to bulldoze this for a little road into this place, or, oh, we have another oil and gas well here, that's 5 acres there, or, you know, we have this little mining claim, that's 2 acres here. Well, that starts to add up over time.
Current estimates are that nearly half of sagebrush habitat is gone because of human activities, and increasingly from fires, like at this charred site we're walking through now, about 100 miles north of the Colorado-Wyoming border.
These were probably 150-year-old sagebrush, dead, gone, forever.
That's a devastating loss for the pronghorn, deer, elk, and other wildlife that depend on this ecosystem, and also for the vast amounts of carbon the deep-rooted plants store. Once sagebrush are destroyed, it could take 100 years for them to come back. The BLM wants to restore these habitats in large part because of shrinking numbers of greater sage grouse, birds best known for their spectacular courtship dances in the spring. Gina says just scattering seeds on the ground really doesn't work to establish the plants, though they've tried. And so today, among blackened nubs of dead sagebrush on this barren hillside, I'm seeing little yellow cages about 12 inches tall, inside which Gina and her colleagues have hand-planted seedlings one by one. It's arduous and time-consuming, but they got a little help from a surprising source.
My name is Levi George, and I am at the Wyoming State Honor Farm.
The Wyoming Honor Farm is a minimum security prison in Riverton, Wyoming, a couple of hours north of here. Through a program called the Sagebrush in Prisons Project, inmates like Levi are helping the BLM by raising sagebrush from seed.
Yeah, we start from the beginning. We mix the dirt and the soil, make sure the pH levels are where they need to be. And then we do the seedlings. And then throughout the year, we water and fertilize them.
Had you ever raised plants from seeds before?
No.
How did that make you feel?
It was great. It was very therapeutic, and it's nice to see something grow from nothing. So being able to nurture them and watch them grow, to me, was very soothing.
The plants the inmates grew in 6 months that are going into the burn area are now about 3 inches tall. If they had been grown from seeds in the wild, it would have taken 5 years to get to the same height. The idea is to give sagebrush restoration a jump start and offer inmates a fresh start.
At the end of the program, we give every participant a certificate. It talks about the skills that they've acquired.
That's Stacy Moore with the Institute for Applied Ecology. The nonprofit created the Sagebrush in Prisons program in partnership with the BLM and now work in 11 prisons, including ones in Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, and California.
We feel it's enriching the inmates' lives, that we're giving them education skills, horticulture skills, certificates, helping them with pro-social behaviors. And we find more inmates are wanting to do the program than there are openings.
The experience convinced Levi, who's due to be released within days, to apply to work for the BLM.
I plan on still continuing to work with them after my release here and try to help other people that's been in my situation when they get out to have somewhere to start from, because it's hard for felons to get, you know, employment sometimes. So
with the Sagebrush Project, prisons are reporting less violence, and studies show programs like these are reducing recidivism. Inmates say giving back to the community meant a lot.
It's just knowing that you had a part of something that you're giving life to that's gonna hopefully sustain other life forms. It's a big deal.
It's also a big deal for the newly planted sagebrush. They'll thrive thanks to the help of the inmates who nurtured the seedlings and in that process grew themselves. For H2O Radio near Hanna, Wyoming, I'm Franny Halperin.
We now go to Chris Moore's weekly commentary, Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Chances are very good if you are listening to this right now. You know that abortion rights are being imperiled now as never before. The Supreme Court's questioning during consideration of the Mississippi law banning abortions months before fetal viability signals that there are five justices probably willing to completely overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, now says the best way to protect the right to abortion is by codifying the Roe v. Wade verdict through legislation. The Women's Health Protection Act, or WHPA, is federal legislation that would protect the right to access abortion care throughout the United States by creating a safeguard against bans and medically unnecessary restrictions. It is already passed in the House, where it had 176 original co-sponsors, and it is now being considered in the Senate. Right out of the gate, there were 48 supporters in the Senate, a record high level of support for a bill upon its introduction. WHPA is a statutory version of the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade decision of 1973, guaranteeing by law the right for healthcare people to perform abortions and the right for their patients to get them without medically unnecessary restrictions unique to anti-abortion laws. Legislators have already passed some 500 state laws restricting abortion since 2010, eliminating access to abortion in vast regions of our country. Some 90% of U.S. counties have no abortion providers. 5 states have only 1 clinic in the entire state. The people hurt most by abortion restrictions are those who already face barriers to accessing health care, including Black, Indigenous people of color, those working to make ends meet, members of the LGBTQ+ community, immigrants, young people, those living in rural communities, and people with disabilities. Chuck Todd of NBC's Meet the Press asked Senator Klobuchar if we should consider regulations through the House and Senate, or perhaps referenda, instead of Supreme Court decisions. Klobuchar now supports codifying the 1973 decision through legislation. Quote, 50 years of precedent, as Elena Kagan pointed out, 50 years of decisions and court decisions, part of the very fabric of women's existence in this country. This is how our country protected rights. And now they're willing to just flip it on its head. Quote, the answer may well be doing it through the political process now. I don't think that's the right thing to do, but it may be the only way to do it. And I think the best way to do it is not a patchwork of state laws, but to codify Roe v. Wade. The Minnesota Democrat also claims that some pro-choice Republicans have signaled an interest in codifying Roe v. Wade. The bill will face an uphill battle in the Senate. If you have thoughts on the Women's Health Protection Act, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Time now for Naturally with herbalist Brigitte Mars.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars to talk about some of the herbs that we use in our holiday traditions. And why do we use them? Well, we do know that this time near the winter solstice, when the days are shorter and the nights are long, that since about 700 AD, people have decorated evergreen trees, which are a symbol of eternal life because they stay green even during the winter. They would often be decorated with things that were red and colorful, very often decorated even outdoors, as a way of coaxing nature to bloom again. And nature, sunshine, come back. So evergreens have been decorated with stars, the star representing the unity of all the elements, and it was considered a pagan holiday, so the church discouraged decorating trees. However, when Queen Victoria decorated a fir tree in Windsor Castle in 1841, the tradition became accepted as A-OK. Of course, if you don't want to get a tree, what I like to do is just diffuse some essential oils like fir or spruce or pine. Then you don't have to vacuum up all those dead leaves, but there's lots of ways that we can do trees more environmentally to replant them, to get an artificial tree, to give our tree back to nature so it can be a shelter for little animals, rabbits, and creatures of the forest. But we know that organic pine trees in the wild are actually a good source of vitamin C and are often used in the bath for sore muscles. Now, frankincense and myrrh, a lot of us could probably understand why the three wise men brought gold, but frankincense and myrrh, well, we know in the ancient world that the idea of burning pleasant-smelling resins was a way of sending one's prayers heavenward. And both frankincense and myrrh are very antimicrobial. They would be burned in public places of worship to help prevent the spread of airborne diseases. Both are resins from shrubs that grow in the Mideast around the Dead Sea. They have both been used as preservatives and embalming the dead, and even internally as tea or tincture or salve for treating all kinds of infection. So these were indeed very useful gifts because they could help you treat cuts, wounds, colds, flus, fever, etc. So indeed, wise gifts. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
thank you for joining us on today's Morning Magazine. Special thanks to Jamie Sudler, Shay Castle, Franny Halperin, Chris Moore, and Brigitte Mars for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Alexis Kenyon has been operating the board. A reminder that if you'd like to share a comment with KGNU, call us at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25 during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for the latest commentary from Jim Hightower, then the Rising Tide podcast and Just Solutions. But first, these news headlines from the BBC.